And you should have saved that record. Hello, this is Hatem from Live from America podcast, alongside Mr. Norm Dorman, the owner of the Legendary Comedy Cellar, and he's going to say something as soon as I say Legendary Comedy Cellar. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I was the owner. Now it's in, in suspended animation. It's like the, anybody, well, introduced, but I saw Planet of the Apes recently, and I'd forgotten that the first scene in Planet of the Apes is in the spaceship where they wake up out of suspended animation, but one of the people actually doesn't wake up. It's just like didn't work and they're aged and they're dead, one of the astronauts. And I think a lot of businesses, a certain number of businesses are going to be that poor astronaut that didn't wake up after all this. So I'm hoping I'm Charlton Heston and not that poor woman.
Or
You are.
Sylvester Stallone and Wesley Snipes.
Yeah, I want to be Sylvester Stallone.
Oh, that too. And that was the voice of the legendary, since we're talking legendary, comedian Boris Hyken, who was hiking last week.
What a connection to be made. I gotta say, also, Gnome with the beard, you look like my ghost of Christmas future right now.
Yeah, I had a beard like yours.
And our guest of honor is Mr. Mike Jason. He recently retired from the US Army after about 25 years in uniform. He commanded troops all over, just to name a few, in Germany, Iraq, Afghanistan, served multiple tours in the Pentagon and NATO, and he's here now. Welcome,
Right.
sir.
With a great haircut, by the way. I think my pandemic haircut is really killing it today.
That's awesome. By the way, this makes me look like I dye my hair, right? A lot of people ask me, but I don't dye my hair. It's just something.
Right.
I just have a different color in my beard. I don't know what that is.
That's what I said too, all the time. Yeah.
What?
That I have the same, I don't dye my hair. It's just, it's that natural.
Do you dye your hair? A little
Be
bit, huh?
talking to him.
So vain.
Mike, welcome. How does it feel to be retired after all these years?
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's been a lot of fun. I get to do things like this. I can speak out of school, so to speak, and spend more time with the family and just be participant, be a citizen participating in everything that's going on. So, miss some of it, but it's great again to do new things.
Yeah. So my question for you, like, I always like to ask that, especially if I'm for veterans, been in service for a long time. How do we get the right pictures? Like, you serve in like Iraq, Germany, Afghanistan, all that. Do you
Yeah.
think the media and everybody here gets the right picture about what's really going on there?
Oh man, where do you want me to start? I mean, it's no, the answer is
Anything
no.
anti-Jew, just go right ahead.
Yeah, I mean, look, if we follow the zeitgeist, everybody's a freaking Navy SEAL out there. I love to say that if the perfect war movie would be about 12 hours long, extremely boring, with about 30 seconds of absolute sheer madness and terror. A lot of it is banal, it's complex, it's bureaucratic, but it's also filled with wonderfully amazing people. And it's not just Sarge and the stupid lieutenant and the brazenly political general who's having an affair. I mean, it's all the tropes and the disturbed veteran. Like I said, everybody's a SEAL, everybody's a Ranger. It's just not like that. It's a great representation of America. It's highly professional. There's wonderful people. There's stupid people. There's selfish people. But overall, it's just a phenomenal experience, I think, that most of us come away with a degree of pride. I've learned a lot. I got master's degrees from it. I traveled the world. I don't, the snapshots we get in 240 bytes or, characters and in the movies, it doesn't do us really any justice. It's yeah. So no, the answer is no. What does it take to come out of it so psychologically healthy? I have a friend that's was in Afghanistan, and he was like a neurotic Jew to begin with. So honestly, I don't even know where his issues began pre or post military. But like, I've known him for probably nearly 10 years now, and he's like improved drastically. But what's the divide? Is it, I mean, obviously it's not just a matter of personal strength, that feels like too much to put on one individual. How do you come out of it as like, it seems like you really got your shit together.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of, I mean, we're an all volunteer force. We have been since 73, right? So there's a self-selection process out there. There are people that are drawn to it for
I've often thought there's like three or four archetypes up there. You know, there's like the high school quarterback captain that wants to be challenged, and you know, there's people finding themselves. Like, there's all kinds of reasons people join, but it is self-selective. So that you begin with what you get, right? And then you add to that mold. I think most people leave well-adjusted. I think they can take it in and have solid experiences. But something I learned, and all things being equal, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, you know, saw a lot of stuff. And you learn that what you go in with is what the baggage is added on top, you know? So if you had a rough childhood and then you add combat trauma to it, you know, then you shake it up and then you get this thing on the other side. But there are multiple opportunities to grow. It's a growth experience. These stressors can be growth experiences. And then there's, I think most people come out the other side, I think, with a really valuable life experience. Others don't. And then that's where I think the focus of our culture and our systems need to go and help out.
What do you think about the all volunteer force? I mean, I could make the argument that if we'd had a draft,
sure,
we would have had a lot less war in the last 30 years, right?
I think that's fair. I love academically saying, I wish we had a draft, the greatest generation, put everybody in uniform, mix them up, right? People from the city, people from the country, you got to make the bunk together, you got to suck it together, you know, like, you know, you got to be hardcore in the rain and muddy and share blankets and, you know, all those experiences that our grandparents tell us about being, you know, in World War II and beyond. And then you come out of it like a better citizen, right? But, you know, when you look at the numbers, we already had a selection process even for World War II or Vietnam. Vietnam, extremely unfair. We all know that. It hit the poor and populations of color deeply. But if to have the same amount of fairness that we had in World War II based on the current size of our population and the fact that it's men and women, I think it's something we need to have a military that's like 50 million strong to have like the same ratio of selection. And what do you do with 50 million people? So to not have that, then you have to be even more selective. So who do you pick? And that becomes, so that's the academic art. That's really why it doesn't work. Philosophically, I'm 100% with you. And I know that McChrystal, General McChrystal, he's really big into a bigger national service. You know, we could put teachers, we could have people now with the pandemic, and then, you know, help with college education and kind of a more national piece. But I fall on the side that I think if more Americans were brought together to work big problems together and they could, you know, we get to know each other better. It's a great experience.
I agree.
I kind of disagree for a minute, if I may, Norm, because if it's a draft and everybody's in, then people like me going to be in the military and we're not going to be, you know, who's fighting who. It's going to be kind of confusing a little bit.
It was important to mix the races and the classes together.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be. I mean, the two issues. One is like national service where everybody at 18 or 21, whatever, just devotes a year to his country, which benefits the country and benefits the social fabric. And the other thing is just like to know that when somebody's advocating war, that but when we start picking the soldiers, it could be your kid is just as likely as the black kids.
That's right.
And that's a good speed bump for people to think extra carefully about what they're actually advocating, you know?
Well, we have completely severed the democratic process in war making, right? I mean, we are running the same authorization of military force for all these conflicts that we passed after 9/11 19 years ago. So Congress has not had to vote or declare war or really ask permission to their constituent, you know, get accountability from your constituents for conflict for 19 years. And that's the real issue. You know, all volunteer force is only since 73. And we've had 19 years of war using this very experimental all volunteer force for the longest war we've ever had with all volunteers. And we just went shopping back home and we never really held our Congress accountable for that and or any of our elected leadership. And so therefore, we as citizens, now I'm a voter, we're not really in a dialogue. And we severed that.
Can we put that cat back in the bag? Because it feels like at this point, like executive power is only expanding. Yeah. And now, you know, the each party is so afraid of the other that I don't really see one contracting executive power once they get their person in office. Like right now, if there's a blue wave, I don't see Democrat. I mean, they're going to stack. They're looking to expand their influence and prevent potentially us having another Republican president ever again.
We have to. We have to knock off that supporting the troops means free Starbucks, flyovers at the freaking football game, don't kneel on the flag, and just let's just keep writing you $700 billion checks, but I don't care what you do because it's somebody else's kid. I mean, we have to get the troops off this pedestal. It's not good for the military. It's not good for our veterans. It's not good for American society. That's not what we're about. We're a nation founded weary of standing armies. We're a standing army that has been fighting a war for 19 years. We have to put the toothpaste back in the tube. And you're right. I don't know how, but I think we can.
I want to ask you something, and I think Noam, you know, can really feel this one, or anybody that has a kid. I had dinner with a friend of mine yesterday, and he was telling me about his niece. She just turned 18, and she's psychologically not right, and she want to join the Marine. And the recruiters are forcing her, like they kind of like her dad is trying to step in and be like, be helpful, go with her to the meetings and all that. But he told her to the recruiter, he's like, listen, she's not correct. She's just trying to, and he doesn't care. He just wanted her to get there, you know?
So let me tell you, Hatem, we went through that with Nicholas, you know.
Oh, really?
My stepson. Yeah. And he didn't end up going. I kind of wish he had, but he was just here a second ago. He had all kinds of issues, and you're exactly right. The recruiter was so aggressive. Obviously, he was trying to fill a quota or whatever it is. I don't know, you know, how to analyze that whole system and how it would work with different incentives. But yes, they don't really care about the kid they're recruiting. I don't know what they're talking about.
So I guess my question is 18 the right age to join a military? I mean, to make a decision to join a military?
By the time you're 25, nobody would go.
Yeah, right.
Physically, it's got to be right.
You remember
physically.
Greg
that's
Giraldo,
the model, right?
Greg Giraldo. Let Mike answer. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question. Giraldo, the great comedian that passed away, he said, you know, actually recruiting should be from 35 because nobody's more angry than when you're that age.
Well, you know, World War II soldiers were a lot older, even when we had to draft. The model is kind of 18 plus an 18-year-old out of high school, not going to college, doesn't have a career, and you know, front reptilian brain not fully formed, right? Also, you know, why do we like young troopers? You know, young men primarily has been the model. I mean, we have women, of course, now, but young men, 18 or 34, lack impulse control. You know, that's what makes 18-year-olds jump out of perfectly good aircraft with a parachute strapped on their back and charge a machine gun nest. I mean that's the model, but that's also the impulse control why we have across the country, not just the military, you know, a suicide problem with young men, right? That impulse control. So there is a sense that young men is young men and women, but has been young men for a couple hundred years here, is sort of the model. Now, is that the right age? Are they the right maturity? The military does provide, you know, maturity, education, you know, discipline, a structure for people. You know, I have a younger brother who enlisted in Marines. You know, his two older brothers are officers. We are four academy graduates. The youngest, just one day without telling anybody, goes to a recruiting station and comes home and he's going to be a Marine, like at 18. It just shocked the whole family. So there's that impulse control. But it was what, you know, he did it and he went two tours in Iraq. And he found the structure or what he was looking for at the time. You know, the aggressiveness of
impregnating someone.
Well,
not mutually exclusive. Touché.
That's right. A couple marriages, you know, no, he's doing fine. Purple Heart recipient. I mean, he's done a lot. But you know, the aggressiveness of the recruiter, I mean, it's the classic, right? I mean, we all saw Stripes. I don't know how we square that corner because they're under a lot of pressure. The military wants high school graduates, no drugs, no criminal record. I mean, the last stat I saw is 86% are not suitable for the military. Now, I reject that argument because I don't like the government or the military saying 86% of the country is not good enough to defend it. I think that's what that says. I like the idea that if you really want to serve, we'll find a place for you if you got the heart and dedication to do the mission. You know, I don't know what kind of athlete I need to fly a drone out of Nevada. You know,
also it should depend which drugs, right? Like, you know, not all drugs are created equal.
That's right. Well, we got to get away from, I need a 6'2", you know, blonde hair, blue eyed paratrooper from Nebraska. You know, I may need a guy with a nose ring and gauges and blue hair, that is a master hacker. That's probably what I need more for the 21st century.
That's when you go to John McAfee argument,
which is why the draft is important, because we need access to all American talent in all shapes and colors when we need it. And we may not need, again, young 18-year-old men for the next one, but we may have to draft 10,000 hackers. So we got to have access to that population. And I think it's everybody potentially is available.
You know, it'd be great.
I got two things to ask you. First of all, I'll do it in the opposite order. What do you think about women in combat?
Okay. Look, it's fine. It's about time. We need to have access to all the talent. Okay. What we learned in Afghanistan, which is a very male dominated society, is all of a sudden we could not even go near women in that culture. Well, we started putting women with special forces and ranger teams because you got to search them. And also you got to talk to them. You can't not have access to 50% of a population of a country during a conflict.
Okay. So can I stop you there for one second? Yeah. What you're saying is very interesting to me, and what you're describing is a scenario where women are perfect for the job.
Very specific, yes.
Right. What about the scenario where women are actually not perfect for the job? Like if the NFL decided we have to take women too, but we're doing it just for the sake of having women in that job. So we're going to, you know, we're going to search for the 1 out of 10,000 female that can actually hold her own, if there's even that, you know, on the front lines, you know, in a combat situation. Is that just politics? I mean,
Nonsense. It's total nonsense. Look, there are women that have graduated the hardest Army school already, a Ranger school. They totally handled it. They didn't lower the standards. They did fine. If they want to do it, if they can meet, and then now we say we can meet the standards, then do it. The question is, what are those standards and why are they there? And we know that standards are subjective things put in by people and leaders based on the conditions of the time, right? So and why are they there? Some of them were put in, frankly, to be exclusive in nature, whether it's from our racist history. You know, there's a cliche that, you know, African-Americans can't swim, right? So they have a hard time. Well, it's because there's not a whole lot of country club pools, you know, in the cities. And also they were excluded from those places for most of our American history. But all of a sudden there's a swim test for the school. Well, why? Do we still go on troop ships? Why is it so important to swim? And how can we bridge that gap? Or get rid of the standard to begin with. So there's multiple. So again, you got to look at, but they're doing it right now in the Army. They've been in paratroop units for 20 some odd years. They're now in my type of units. They're tankers. They're on tank crews. I've served with women. They bring incredible talent, new perspectives, and break that stupid locker room bravado, grab them by the junk nonsense, and really professionalize in organizations. Yeah, people have to watch what they say more. Better. I mean, we become more professional.
There are always these counterintuitive things which are really worth thinking about. So for instance, in the nightclub business, I've found that I wish I could have only women security guards. They're way better, you know, at defusing situations and at not starting fights, you know. So there are, I do agree with you very much that when you start to take an unbiased look at things, you find ways that different things can help you in ways you couldn't imagine. Right. I am always skeptical of women in hand-to-hand combat. You know, I just am. Maybe that's sexism. I don't know. Like if I had an injured leg and I couldn't walk and the enemy was coming at me, I think I'd want a dude there fighting them off for me, you know, but that doesn't mean women shouldn't be fully used in the Army. I just, you know.
The numbers of incidents of hand-to-hand combat and, you know, really, it happens. But we had a woman get a Silver Star. She's like smaller than she's like 5'1", maybe. She was a squad leader. She was injured. And her squad got ambushed in Iraq. And she charged a trench line with a rifle and like killed something like 12 insurgents.
Wow.
While wounded. Got a Silver Star. Her name is Sergeant Hester. So Google that one.
Yeah, we got to get her on the show. That's an amazing story.
You should.
This is how much the Iraqi have respect for women. They wouldn't attack back, you know?
I interrupted you.
Yeah, I was just curious how you juxtapose the idea of like getting rid of the locker room, grab them by the pussy bravado with looking for people that have poor impulse control and are 18 years old. Like, it feels like what you want, honestly, is a bunch of dudes who might use language like that, who are also I don't know. I have friends that have been like, I don't know if it's super respectful or just not alpha type dudes that might speak like that. Those are also dudes that I might not want to be in the trenches with necessarily, you know?
Yeah. It's fair because that's been the assumption that like I need those misogynistic alpha male types because that's who fights and that's who wins and blah, 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 blah. And how do you mix it all together? I think we're learning that is just, it's an assumption. It's a trope and it's not necessarily true. What we want are really smart people. Look down at the very basic infantry squad, the kids on the ground with the rifles that are clearing the trenches, right? These guys are using drones. They're using cyber stuff that is unbelievable tech, robotics. And
not your grandpa's army.
It is not your grandpa's army, and it takes all kinds. And those resources are getting pushed down at the lower and lower and lower level. We've had female soldiers that are dog handlers go right in with the Rangers, you know, on raids because the dogs can sniff bombs, you know, going out to kill target Al Qaeda, like black helicopter missions. So it's fine. And I think that, again, that bravado, misogynistic crap, we've lulled ourselves into thinking that's somehow necessary in our society. And having grown up overseas, it's just bullshit. It's just bullshit. We don't need it. Yeah. It's intuitively American. It's our thing. You know, we own that piece, but it doesn't make us any better than anybody else. It actually holds us back.
I would just say, to be fair, you might, and I'm certainly can contradict me here. I don't know if misogyny is the word I would use for that mentality. I don't think it's protective. It may be chauvinistic in a way. It's not hateful of women. It's it can be quite adoring of women. You just don't, you know.
In a condescending way, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
is you're the weaker. I'm the alpha protector.
Yeah,
you're the weaker sex.
I mean, we see the same thing.
I wouldn't call that misogyny.
When you have a female referee, you know, once you made a mistake, the same mistake a male referee can do, everybody goes like, come on, seriously, you know?
But it's
you say it's not your grandpa's army, but in grandpa's army, how well would it have worked to have women fighting?
The Russians did it. The Russians did it in World War II. They had female tank crews. They had females inside their staffs.
But they were also fine murdering millions and millions to win the war. they just threw bodies at the war.
And
as a Russian,
not to mention,
don't talk Russia to Boris. All right.
Yeah.
I'm not making a joke, but even terrorist organization, you know, are equal opportunity now with suicide bombing, you know?
Yes.
I would be interested to take a really close look at how Israel's handled this because Israel obviously had to do what it had to do. I'm sure that they found that using women or men, I mean, you could look at it either way, you know, you could look at other tasks and say, well, men are really not that well suited for this. Right. And nobody would call that misanthrope. Not what's the word for hating men?
Misanthropic. Misanthrope. Misandry.
Misandry. Yeah.
Just quick
when you look at it from the other end of the telescope, you wouldn't call it misandry, but I'm sure you can make the argument that there's certain things that we should just have women for this. They're way better at it, you know.
Yeah, just a quick stat.
All nervous about.
Stat for everybody who's listening or watching. It's only been 25 minutes, and no mention Israel. Usually, it's that's a record for us because usually he would mention it with 10 to 20 minutes.
I have a two-part question based on this evolved army. So it makes me think of two things. On the one hand, having this army that totally makes sense that the army's changed. And that the jobs have changed and you have more jobs that are reliant on intellectual skills versus physical ability. To me, on the one hand, that makes me think that like, well, in general, is that going to change the dynamic to reflect what's happening right now in the workforce, where you have a working class that's being gutted out because we just don't need as many of those jobs. And so are we going to end up in a situation where the draft requires a higher and higher IQ or set of skills necessarily or whatever it is. Right.
It's already happening.
So is there a repercussion there where we might be short on those people? And then the flip side of that. Yeah. And the flip side of that, though, is this idea of, you know, not misogyny, but like males having a defensive role that sort of feels almost like caveman era. Like that's still a thing, you know, like even now I see reference with a lot of the stuff that's happening in the streets. It's both like Stalin's playbook and the CIA's playbook that when you want to destabilize the society using a small minority of people, you cause enough chaos in the streets that the males are forced to stay home and defend their families and can't participate in political exchanges. That's like literally like CIA handbook for holding a coup somewhere or like Stalin's. You know, it's just what we do. So does it eventually, if there's enough chaos, do we or do we not go back to this role where it's sort of archaic, and but men have to, if there's somebody that's going to try to fight somebody trying to enter your house, it's not always going to be a man. But I'm a pretty small guy, you know, I'm 5'5". I'm not probably less equipped than any woman that's in the military. But on average, who's going to be, is it going to be me or is it going to be my 5'1" wife, you know?
Well, it'd be interesting. It's, you know, I look at this Zoom session. It's like, here's four dudes trying to figure out, you know, what women should or should not do. I mean, it's this is part of the issue, right? Like, what would they say right now? But to the fitness piece, so it's already happening. That's why we say, you know, the military is constantly only 86% are not capable, because we have all of these requirements from fitness to intellect. So, and you know, criminal record, drug use. You know, I get all these kids now that are on all the pills all the time. That requires a series of waivers. So we have all these requirements because the military is that much more complex. The systems are more complicated. We got to have background checks. So we're extremely selective already. The idea that, and I think as General Hertling, who retired, he wrote a piece a while ago. He did led a study that the states where they're sacrificing education and healthcare, especially for children, we're having a strategic crisis because they are no longer able to produce, for example, what the military needs. And that's where it was cheap to go recruit, right? That was your Mississippi, your Arkansas, like Georgia. People just came from these places because grandpa was in World War II, dad was in Vietnam. I joined the Marines, I joined the Army. Well, guess what? They've underfunded education, they've underfunded healthcare, the kids are overweight, and they can't join. So what happens when those kind of deep red state populations are no longer eligible to join? Because we're learning that the kids we want with the intellect, the clean record, the physical fitness, the health, and a high school diploma are probably in blue urban cities that are well funded. Well,
they're not going to join the military.
They got other choices. They got other choices, right?
Two quick things, and then we'll move to another subject. One is, like, I think Mike touched on it, which is, you know, military now and war has nothing to do. There's never one and one like the good old days. So, you know, our look has to change it physically. Sure. You know, you don't need to be built and strong and all that, because it's not like UFC anymore, right? So, you know, I don't think
it's still there. It's just not all of it. Most of it is not, whether it's running an aircraft carrier, flying a drone. There's so many other things you can do other than be there with the freaking knife in your hand.
Yeah, and we rarely, even if there's a war, we rarely do a ground war anymore. You know, we let our allies do that. You know, we do from the, you know, from the skies and stuff like that. So, Mike, I wanna ask you, like, now you've been, there's two theories. Some people say, like, the wars, especially in Iraq and Afghanistan, is not justified, blah, blah, all that. And some people say, well, we have to defend the country there, because if we leave it, you know, the terrorist organization is going to bring the war here, you know? So which side do you take? What's your position?
Oh, yeah. So it's pretty huge, right? And I'm personally, you know, tied to Iraq in many ways. I met my wife there. Like, that's like, you know, my brothers have all been there. So Iraq is really important to my family. We have friends there.
Yeah. We have a lot in common, I guess.
You know, Nam Sadie. So it's important to me. The Iraqi people are important to me. Afghanistan, in many ways, the same. And then, of course, Europe. And I lived there multiple stations. So, but looking at stepping back, alliances, our allies, is to me is the most important aspect of our national security and what protects this country. It's being forward, solving problems at the far end, working with our allies, helping democracies grow and stabilize, all those types of things. We can't retrench and be in the United States and then think that nothing is going to happen. You know, that's that 9/11 surprised us. It shouldn't have surprised. You know, we couldn't even remember September 12th. You couldn't even question why it happened. But we know that our foreign policy up to that point was a catalyst for some of these actions. So we've got to discuss that. So I'm a firm believer in NATO, in our alliances, and even Iraq. And I think we're turning back on Iraq again. We've threatened them to pull out of the embassy again. It's like, so, you know, history, and again, I take it from my front seat. So I wasn't in the government. But we all know 2003, for whatever, you know, we can look at the context of 9/11, but it was a bad idea to go in. Then we bled a lot. Iraqis suffered a lot. Troops suffered a lot, but mostly Iraqis, thousands. But we turned the corner, and then before it was fixed, we pulled chocks in 11. We left too quickly, and then we had to go back in for ISIS, and now we're going to leave again too quickly. And they're being rampaged by COVID. You know, ISIS is on a comeback. Iran is influencing. That's just, we abandoned the Kurds. That's just not smart national security strategy. We keep thinking about it in 2-year increments instead of having kind of a long view for what America's role in the world should be.
Can I ask this? Speaking of the long view, I was reading up, somebody discussing the Mike Pompeo speeches on China. And it seemed like there in the long view, China had been watching us wage these wars in Iraq and seeing how we fight. And I don't know if you would agree or not with the concept that basically we've been in a cold war with China for 20, 30 years and not known it. And, you know, I'm seeing, aside from them investing in our schools, having connections to our governors, buying up land that's strategically around military bases. And I don't personally think it would ever go into a hot war in the sense that, you know, we're obviously super economically intertwined, but like we're at this place where, you know, we have even culturally, people are so much more apt, obviously, to, you know, for good reason to call out injustices in our own government. But it just seems such a political hot button to bring up so much of what's happening over there. And yet it seems slowly but surely there's just so much more ownership over not just our economics, but like partially our political process over there.
Yeah, China is an interesting dynamic. They're a completely centralized government, right? So they're not subject to elections. They're not a democracy. So they can turn around like Stalin and do 5, 10-year, 50-year plans, you know, the way he did it. And it's all central government, centrally controlled. And so they've been on a march and they've been telegraphing, frankly, what their strategy has been for a long time. I don't know that they have large, I don't think they've got expansion desires other than maybe Taiwan.
South China Sea.
But influence wise, yes. I mean, we know that I was in Kenya last
They're colonizing
Christmas.
Africa right now.
So they're taking natural resources, they're investing, putting these countries in enormous debt, building harbors, railways. I saw highways being built in Nairobi, you know, with their own work camps that look like FOBs, you know, the bases we had in Iraq, highly fortified. They're not hiring locals. They're shipping in Chinese construction. They live on a camp. They build. They go home at night and they lock the doors. They're not employing the, you know, the citizens there. And then the countries are buying, basically putting themselves into debt. And then they've got they owe to the Chinese.
We're supposed to do that. China's not supposed to do that.
We're supposed to, right? We're supposed to. And that's what we did for the whole Pax Americana post-World War II. We built markets and exported our goodwill and deposed some governments, but generally advanced the cause of freedom and McDonald's.
Yeah, that's the old, what is that? The Golden Arches theory?
Yeah, right.
Which
we've never gone
false,
to war
though.
With a country with McDonald's.
But then we bombed Kosovo, like right after he said that.
Yeah,
which had McDonald's.
Kosovo was right? Yeah, Kosovo was one of my first operations. I was there for 7 months as a commander.
Did you feel that was to distract from the Lewinsky scandal?
No. I think the Balkans was frankly a success. I mean, it's hard to believe that in the mid 90s, so when we were like all adults kind of, and so we had, you know, friends on television, in that era, there was wholesale World War II style genocide going on in Europe. Like the Sarajevo, where the Olympics had been, they were using the luge to throw bodies down. Like I saw, it was Srebrenica massacre. To think that was happening. And so NATO, which wasn't designed to do any of that, but with our leadership, American leadership, goes in and we put the kibosh on it. And it's not perfect, but generally we stopped a massive outbreak of genocide and multiple civil wars. Collaborating. And the Russians were there too. It was actually collaborative with the Russians.
What happened to, what's his name? What was the name of the general? Wesley Clark, was that his name?
Wes Clark, yeah, who almost started World War III or whatever.
Yeah, but wasn't he involved in Kosovo? And he was running. He was a big mouth for a long time, running for president.
I haven't heard from him in years.
He's
on the Twitters. He talks against you know, sort of the corruption and everything. But yeah, his political lodestar crashed and burned in that after that.
Yeah.
But prior to then, I was a child at the time, but I've been reading a lot, particularly about interventionist theory. And prior to then, you know, for a long time, Clinton was super hesitant to intervene over there. And I remember, you know, the discussions that, like, there wasn't a clear innocent party necessarily, that there were similar to Syria, where, you know, depending on how you frame it, it's not quite clear whether there's somebody we should really be arming in the area. And kind of historically, it feels like that's also something that's coming home to roost right now, the fact that we're involved in all these conflicts. And I was reading something like, you know, since like Washington declared neutrality with France, where we wouldn't help them after they helped us in the revolution, we like didn't help. We had no alliances for like the next 100-something years, basically, until the Spanish-American War. Like, is that something that's kind of, like, it feels like that's something that's fueled Trump in a way and populism in a way, where people are, you know, maybe overcompensating for all these different things. And now are just like, how do we do this without it affecting us back home, without a giant army?
It's just leadership. I mean, it's just leadership. Look, when he got elected, Trump could have gone in any direction, and you make a case to the American people. They're not stupid. I always think back of FDR, and they bombed Pearl Harbor, and what do? He's got to convince the American people, who are like, revenge, day of infamy. We're going to go to Germany first. Like, I thought that was the most, that is still to me, that's like after 9/11, you know, we have to go over here.
Well, you can thank the Jews for that, but go ahead. There was no way we were letting you guys go to Japan first. All right. It was clear. We had our agenda and we implemented it.
Well, it was brilliant. He had to tell the American people, like, this is the most dire threat. We got to go here first. The Japanese are going to starve anyways. They don't have the resources, but it had to be done. So it's about the mantle of leadership. You know, it's Kennedy saying we're going to go to the freaking moon, whatever it is. Yes. Even Bush, for all his faults, I give Bush credit for putting everything down on the surge, which, by the way, I was in the Pentagon at the time and they had no idea it was coming. It was planned all at the White House. And he doubles down and says, we're going to do this because we're going to fix it because we broke it. We're going all in. And we're going to turn the corner in Iraq after we broke it. And he was, but he did, that was personal leadership at the time. And I thought, you know, Obama, he didn't want to stay in the wars. He didn't want to do any of this crap, but he had to extend. He had to add some troops. He had to go back in for ISIS. So he had to turn around and sell it and make the case and go back in. Clinton got us into the Balkans. Oh, it's going to be another Vietnam. You know, it's going to be a bloodbath. Well, it wasn't. And he said, it is a moral imperative. We lead, you know, we lead here and do this. So Americans need to hear, this is the plan. This is the strategy. This is where we're going because of these values. And then I'm going to go around and sell it to you and convince you.
So I want instead to ask you a
question. Yeah.
How much bloodshed is saved by the perception that we have a unhinged president as opposed to a very cautious one? Because, for instance, I'm going to predict that Iran is on November 4th, or I'm sorry, January 21st, 2021, Iran is going to reemerge as a mischievous presence in the world. They don't know what the fuck Trump is capable of, and they're just going to wait him out. Obama I mean, I'm not trying to knock Obama, but I think it's fair. Like, the world was so aware that this guy would rather do anything than get involved in anything with guns firing, that they're going to test him to find.
So, I mean, that's the madman theory, right?
Yeah, but I've never heard a good reputation of it.
So, but you know, if you look at those kind of the historical kind of analogy, is always like the reluctant warrior gets a lot more backup when the guns start firing, right? Like FDR was the liberal socialist who dropped, you know, and his successor Truman, the wimp, dropped two nukes. You know, the bellicose conservative Republican is always expected to be the puncher. You know, but look at Reagan, when they bombed the Beirut barracks and he withdrew. You know, a Democrat would have been being accused of a coward. But Reagan just withdrew our forces out of Beirut. Nobody blinked because,
but as you know, bin Laden took note of that. That was a big mistake. That was a big mistake Reagan made.
So I don't know. Like on the Iran thing,
I think that was a seminal event for bin Laden.
We are still pissed off about the humiliation of the 1979 embassy, and we cannot get the fuck over it. Okay. The Iranians have not killed an American on American soil, period, ever. All their dastardly activities has been regional in defense. Why were they supporting insurgents in Iraq? Well, because we were next door. Why were they supporting insurgency in Afghanistan? Because we were boxing them in, and we told the world, we're going to box you in. So they were kind of, it was defective. I'm not defending Iran per se, or the mullahs. I think they're scumbags, and they're oppressing their own people. We could have supported some of those student movements. I don't know if it's ready to flip. I don't think we keep doing the sanction pressure stuff. That shit's not working. We did it to the Iraqis. We starved thousands of people. It does not work. We
also gave them $150 million.
We didn't give them. We didn't give them. We unfroze money that was theirs. Whether that's to bring them to the table for that deal, whether we liked that deal or not. But it's not like we wrote a check to them. It was their assets.
You're right to correct his semantics on it, because it's a tendentious way to present it either way. But the basic point is correct, that all of a sudden now they have resources that they didn't have to do their mischief with, however you want to.
But they weren't doing it. They've been abiding by the deal, and then we just withdrew.
But the resources,
so now there is no deal.
The resources just goes to the government. It doesn't go to the people. And what the government do is they don't share, because I was there. I know they don't share it to make the people feel even more angry towards the U.S. So they sanction not by the U.S. only, but by their own government as well.
Right. The people suffer when we sanction the government. The mullahs, the Saddams, they always get their Rolls Royces and their Lamborghinis and their hookers and blow. Right. They always get that shit. It's the people that suffer. And the more we squeeze, it doesn't cause revolution. It causes more ferocity into the cause.
Is it correct to say it seems like the sanctions only work when they're against specific individuals at the leadership of those governments, rather than kind of general economic strategy like that? That just ends up, oddly enough, you could use the word trickling down to the people in that country and them paying for it.
Yeah, like the Magnitsky Act, you know, with the Russian oligarch guys that are traveling all over, like they hate that shit. And they're putting pressure on Putin, and it's pushing, you know, so those guys are all corrupt, bigger than anything. And it really pisses them off. And that's what we saw, that their meddling they were doing in 15, 16, those meetings was all about relief pressure on those guys. I mean, if they travel around, you know, like what is King Jong-un cares about sanctions on him? Like, he doesn't give a crap. But if they're, you know, more globalist people that are traveling and going to Paris.
Yeah, the Russians got their kids here, you know, they got their kids going to school in America.
Right. So if you're like that, maybe.
What do you think about Iran getting a bomb? I'm afraid.
They're close.
Yeah, I'm afraid that the Overton window has really shifted on that. I would say that there's a lot of people are like, we'll somehow manage it. I think that the arguments for preventing Iran from getting a bomb are at least as compelling, if not quite a bit more compelling, than the arguments that underlay the Cuban Missile Crisis. And we were ready to risk it all to prevent those missiles in Cuba. Iran getting a bomb is way more risky than the missiles in Cuba. The proximity matters not. And on top of that, after seeing Chernobyl, that documentary on HBO, docudrama, it just really brought home to me how dysfunctional we have to assume any dictatorship is in terms of protocols and systems that would protect us from accidental and reckless
nuclear
weapons. So those two, at least the Soviets were grownups. You're talking about Iran. They're not going to, the scientists, they're going to shut up. They'd rather, you know, they're just going to say, yes, boss. You know, they're going to be afraid to be the one to present bad news. They actually execute the messenger in those regimes.
We have, all of this is alive and well in the presence of North Korea right now. We have, the scenario is already there.
Yeah.
So the cat's out of the bag. I don't see Iran as any crazier than North Korea. And all they want to do is for the regime to survive.
You know, there is a difference, but they are crazier because they have a much bigger agenda. North Korea has their atom, I presume, I'm no expert. North Korea wants an atom bomb because they know we want to take them out. And they know, as long as we have this, you can't take me out.
It's regime preservation. That's all it is.
Iran has an agenda that's outward looking,
I disagree.
Well,
I think they're the Shia minority. They're the Shia minority in the region. Everybody hates them. It's about self-preservation.
Well, listen to what they say.
Since 79, we told them our position is to take you out, and they've been on the defense. The Iranians don't want to invade.
Well, it's both.
They don't want to invade anybody else. There's no land expansionist theories out there. They're no more. I don't think they're any more dangerous than the North Koreans.
Well, that's it.
If anything, they're more rational.
Well, let me ask from the Israeli point of view. From the Israeli point of view, which is all that matters.
I'm not Israeli.
Yeah, no, I'm kidding. I'm egging. So if Iran is feeding the enemies of Israel missiles and weapons, whatever it is, and they worry about Israeli retaliation. So they're, whatever, it's cat and mouse. Imagine Iran with an atom bomb, how brazen they would be about just injecting any weapon system at all into Israel's enemies. Because what can Israel do?
Impregnable. We had a plan. Like I said, there was a plan, and they were abiding by the deal. It was actually working, and people
I'm not arguing against the deal.
I don't know if the deal is possible to put back together. I'm somehow not sure about that, even with an administration change. I don't know if you can put the toothpaste back in a thing. But let's take this to the logical extreme. Okay, now they have the bomb. I mean, what are we going to do? Are we going to nuke them? You can't put it back. You cannot put it back.
Well, we got to prevent it.
So they've got it.
We got
to. So the question is, I think you got to bring them to the big boy table. They now have legitimacy, and okay, now you're going to follow the international protocol, and we're all together on this. You're a big boy, and if you sell the technology to somebody else, like we're gonna hammer your nuts.
How?
Well, you give them the incentives to lose, and whether it goes back to do you normalize things more? I mean, they've got it. So
You're gonna back yourself right up into those sanctions that don't work.
Importantly, Noam, why? I know it's kind of like a thing here, but why we worry about Israel's safety more than Israel worry about its safety? Like, what is Israeli plan against it?
Well, Israel has wanted, I think, to take military action, and I believe at least once, maybe twice, they were, you know, kind of told to hold back by the United States.
And since
rightfully so, I'm not arguing towards anything, I'm definitely not arguing against the Iran deal. I don't know enough to say whether it was smart to pull out or not. I know there's a lot of people on both sides.
See, I know that region very well, and I agree with Mike. Iran doesn't want to expand; it want to influence the Shia to be all over the Gulf. But I think they want the bomb to be a powerful nation. Yeah. I don't think they're gonna use it, because if they try to use it, they know it's the end of them.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me kind of like
Pakistan. Pakistan has the freaking bomb, right? No. I mean, and there's degrees of insanity in that country. But it is what it is. They have it. We don't want them to have it, but once they have it, the calculus has to change. I mean, this is old Cold War 101 stuff that we have to kind of put back in our memory banks. and start reasoning.
And I don't remember who's the comedian that says that he's not worried about Iran having the nuclear bomb because they don't have any missiles. So they're going to have to walk the bomb.
So when I was a kid, the mainstream, smart, liberal, Anthony Lewis, New York Times type position, Noam Chomsky, I'm sure, nuclear proliferation was the greatest threat to the future of planet Earth. Proliferation. And now it seems to me that liberals have kind of said, proliferation, we'll deal with it. And I think that's a mistake. Each new atom bomb in the hands of a despot is increasing the risk profile, the uncertainty. It's a big mistake. We're going to rue the day. We're already ruining the
day. I don't think that's
we could have stopped North Korea and we didn't. We could have stopped.
Well, maybe. I don't think that's a liberal perspective. I mean, that's certainly not in the national, the blob, the old blob, you know, the national, from the foreign people to the intelligence people, have all, I think, been consistent about it. And there's been kind of a mechanism to try and prevent further proliferation. And the idea was you sort of chase whack-a-mole. But that's what the whole Iran deal was about, was preventing that proliferation and the pressure on North Korea. North Korea got around it. I think it was that scientist in Pakistan that gave him the bombs.
Khan, right?
Yeah. The Kims are phenomenal at making you feel like you're getting somewhere and then pulling a rug. They're like Lucy with the football. I mean, constantly. So no administration was even changing the script was ever going to get anything out of that guy because that's the way they operate. Yeah. So I don't know. And these are hard problems.
Couple of things I want to say. First of all, it's like, you know, it's kind of like having a daughter and you're trying to, you know, make sure she doesn't date or she doesn't have sex until she grew up. And eventually it's going to happen. So this is the same thing with technology. Yeah. Eventually everyone is going to have that bomb. So the solution is not trying to stop it. I know like Israel's tried to stop it for a long time in the region by killing scientists, by, have spies and destroy.
That is the dumbest thing you've ever said.
What?
That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard you say. We're all going to die. So that's like we're all going to die tomorrow.
I'm saying technology is going to be, everyone is going to figure it out. One day we're all going
to
have
What I'm saying is inevitability is not a good argument to then to throw in the towel now.
Yeah, we're going to die
in our 90s. Go ahead now and do something and take a risk with your life now. It's like you want to put it off. Because as you put things off into the future, kind of like with COVID, you allow for other things to develop, technological or otherwise, that might also change the risk. So maybe you're assuming that Iran is eventually going to get a bomb, and also that Iran will always be run by a despot dictatorship. Well, actually, you know what? If you kick the can down 50 years, maybe Iran will, right, people will rise up and we will end that thing. Just like the people used to say a separate peace will never happen in the Middle East. The Arabs will never make peace with Israel unless the Palestinian issue is taken care of. And my father used to say, don't be so sure. At some point, they may see their interests differently. And look what's happening now.
Well, two things. First of all, the 25% Israeli in you just won't let me finish my sentence. What I'm saying is like...
I'm saving you from yourself. Go ahead.
When eventually everybody is going to have the technology, everybody's going to be able to do it. So the solution is not trying to stop them. The solution is trying to figure out a way of making everybody civilized and everybody...
What are you going to do?
Yeah, so
they want it for regime protection, but it's also extremely expensive. You got to maintain it. And we want the IEA to inspect this stuff to make sure it's safe so we don't get a Chernobyl. Once you've got it, you got to play big boy
rules. I tell you, Norm, about all the right things. First of all, I predicted that, you know, the world is going to change in the Middle East. It's going to be more peaceful, you know. And I told you that long time ago because of the information that we're getting now. Because of the internet and all the stuff, people are getting the right picture. People understand what's going on. I told Noam before the story over and over, you know, in the Middle East, they used to have a reporter asking a question to the president and he will answer one answer in English and one answer in Arabic, you know. But now that people figure out what's going on and they know that Israel is not the worst enemy. They don't get me wrong, they're awful, but I'm not saying, you know, but they're not that, you know, but they figure out that we are awful as well, you know, so they work things out.
Can I ask you to pause there for a second? Because what you're saying is very interesting. It is a close cousin of the rationale in Iraq. The whole Wolfowitz rationale was that if you bring daylight into the Middle East, that it would reform itself. They tried to do it militarily, exactly. And it backfired. But the underlying rationale, as you're describing, was not crazy, actually. It was naive to think this was the way to accomplish it. But the internet is doing very much what we were hoping to do with the point of a gun.
Exactly.
Although social media and the internet also gave us the rise of self-radicalization with ISIS and the same nonsense that we're seeing in this country, quite frankly. So, it's a mixed bag. The internet is wonderful. All this stuff has been great, but let's not fool ourselves that it didn't, you know, the conspiracy theories in the Middle East and the videos that were being shared, the beheading videos, the ISIS recruited through Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
So conspiracy theories can fly even, you know, everywhere.
The baseline of conspiracy theories in America was relatively low. So the internet has really degraded that. But in the Middle East, the baseline was quite high to begin with. And I don't know if it had much impact.
I mean, just to be very, very simple, like even something like the Holocaust, you know,
another conspiracy theory.
There's a big denial in the Middle East that never happened. But now that people see videos and watch Spielberg movies and listen to all the Jews on, you know, they actually, the tone changed. I never saw an official paper say the Holocaust and what happened to the Jews is horrible. Now it's happening all over. You know what I'm saying? So, and another
thing,
Anthony Jeselnik's joke, he says, my grandmother, she just couldn't believe the Holocaust actually happened. She always denied the Holocaust. So finally I brought a rabbi in to talk to her. And now she can't believe it only happened once.
is it a fair analogy maybe with the kind of power of social media to kind of relate it to nuclear power, essentially? You know, when that was first developed, obviously there was, you know, a risk and a benefit, and here we are however many years later. And
Boris,
I'm
sorry, I just want to add one more point before we jump to that. Just to be fair with that social media, I also think it helps that Israeli can get caught, you know, because they get filmed anyway, so they're more careful now. So that's
well, just
thing.
Like our cops here, right? Or
exactly.
I know you're making a joke, but everybody
be nice to the Jews the whole time. You know?
Listen, we'll always be one step ahead of you. Everybody knows.
No, you can't say the quiet part out loud.
Oh, sorry.
This is why these things happen. No, but it feels like, you know, obviously we've gotten the benefit of nuclear energy. We've gotten the benefit of it potentially with diplomacy. I've even heard the term like nuclear privilege, where like a lot of these countries want nuclear power just for sitting at the table in the world. Like that's
right.
What Kim Jong-un's whole thing is.
And
like,
to not be deposed like Gaddafi.
Yeah, exactly.
Not to end up in a ditch.
Right, because you can potentially have really large consequences to that. And so the threat is never gone. I forget who it is. It was a really old, I think it was like a Sam Harris or a Hidden Forces that I heard with an older general who was responsible for going into Ukraine after the Cold War and getting all the nuclear, like, so that it doesn't get sold to any random
right.
buyers. And we used it afterwards. And so the threat is still there. I've heard that the threat of nuclear war today, you know, is technically the highest it's ever been, because there's just these systems that are set up where we could even just accidentally, our computers can perceive that someone else is about to fire. And we've had a couple of those close calls.
Very close calls. And right. Russia too.
We had the dedicated phone lines, right? That American general in the bunker could pick up a red phone and talk to his counterpart in Moscow. He's like, no, dude, it's Santa Claus,
right?
Like on your radar, like no. And all that stuff has been degraded. And this is kind of the, if you want to talk Gerasimov doctrine, the kind of the Russian gray space stuff. But we have increased this gray area, this zone of where you can misperceive something so dramatically and severed all the systems where we talk to each other. And so now you've got little green men, and it's like, is this, you know, are they buying, you know, they're buying media, Is you right. know they're doing massive they're tweet bots. Like, is this war? Is this not war? And the risk is increased dramatically, and the cost is still high.
Our friend Fred Kaplan has a book out this year called The Bomb. I don't know if you saw it, and it's all about these things. But one of the stories he tells there is about literally a Russian guy somewhere in Siberia who just chose to ignore the clear indication that America had launched missiles. I mean, there was no fail safe except that it just didn't sit right with him. He couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
So he just let it. He would have been, you know, he defied all his protocols. So, yeah, I mean, that gets back to what I'm worried about with Iran, because
did they kill him anyway?
No, I don't think I'm saying, like, if we've had such close calls in the most sophisticated nations, what can you imagine is going to happen? They're still using tubes as opposed to transistors.
So you're Iran and North Korea, and you know that if you make a mistake or one of your people makes a mistake, the United States, Russia, China, somebody is just going to turn you into sea glass.
Yeah.
So the pressure on them to kind of get it right and make sure they're straight, I think, and their little ally buddies is extremely high. I take a little bit of solace in that. Like, they know, like, they make one accident, there's no coming back.
And this is what I would do if I was Kim Jong Un. I would blow up one bomb, and then I would create a bunch of dummy fake bombs and I wouldn't even tell anybody they were fake, and I just hand them all out to the. And that's all you need.
Saddam,
that's
right?
That's so right. That was Saddam.
Saddam thought he had the bombs because his people were telling him, because they were too afraid of being executed. They didn't have shit. And we were intercepting those messages. So we're like, oh, they have the yellow cake and all that shit. And the reality is they were too incompetent to get it done, but nobody wanted to tell Saddam he didn't have it. So, and Saddam thought he had it. So
sounds like my restaurant. Go ahead.
I was going to say, that's what I used to do to Noam. We told him the show sold out.
Before we go, I want to just pivot to something which might be related to you or might not. If not, we can move on. So in the military, you got to know and work with a lot of the cohort, which is the word they use now, the demographic group that votes for Trump, the deplorables. A lot of these people are soldiers. And I'm wondering
it's a mix.
What's that?
It's a mix.
Yeah, right. But there's a good number of them in the thing. So you know them in a way that I imagine you have affection for some of these people. You know, they were good guys.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, recently on NBC, John Meacham referred to Trump supporters as having reptile brains, reptilians. And that really disturbed me because, first of all, I feel like I hate the elites. But second of all, the classic, and it's real, it's not a cliche, the classic road to bigotry is to dehumanize.
Yeah.
Like, it's classic. And what is a more pure example of dehumanizing than saying, well, to be a Trump supporter, you have to be a reptile. And I'm wondering, as someone who actually, you know, depended for his life maybe on some of these reptiles, what do you think about the Trump supporters? Where are they coming from?
So, I mean, I'm guessing he went, so we all have a portion of our brain called the reptilian brain, right? And that's what drives, like, deep-seated, what do you call it? It's where fear, fear, yeah. it is the basic core of our brain that allows us to survive. So I'm guessing his argument is these people are operating right now out of deep-seated emotional fear of survival and not, I don't know, being elite and rationalizing societal constructs or something. So, okay. The army is as a reflection, as a huge army, is a reflection of the American public. And I have very close people that I've served with, that I fought with, that are on different sides of the aisle. I, at one point, was on a completely different side of the aisle. Then I was on no aisle, and now I'm on another side of the aisle. You know, I'm a person who has maneuvered my adult life through various tribes. You know, I was Alex P. Keaton in high school and carried a briefcase, was on a debate team and loved Reagan. And then I slowly became apolitical because my mentors were like, officers don't vote. You just serve whoever, you know, and I was told to hate the pot smoking draft dodger because that's what we did. And we all had Fox News playing at the headquarters. And then, you know, you evolve. We're very diverse. And it's, I like to think we can still, you know, argue. I mean, there are some folks that are off the deep end, that I respect, mentors of mine, former soldiers of mine, but they're off the deep end. The crap they're posting on social media It's not a difference of politics. It truly is deplorable. And I'm struggling with, we grew up together in the Army. We served together. How can you justify some of this stuff that's coming out? Like, I get you might like this, but you can't morally justify this. And I struggle with it. Some are more pragmatic. And then there's the other, you know, somewhere on the other side are completely off the deep end. So it's, I'll just say it's been very personally divisive and frustrating, and in many ways painful to see if their values, if their morals, they should be deep seated, and we shouldn't sway from them, regardless of what our policy choices are. We can clearly say, look, I like this, but I know this is immoral, but I'm okay with it because I'm going to compromise because I need this. But if you move along the spectrum of morality and values, then there weren't really morality and values to begin with, if that makes sense. And some people that I truly love, I've seen go down that path, and it's been hurtful and kind of divisive.
I hear what you're saying, but I think it's inexcusable. I think that, I'm not one of these people, but I think the Democratic Party, I think this is pretty fair to say, does a good impression of caring more about illegal immigrants than it does about the white working class. And just from a psychological point of view, you know, Hatem understands, my enemy's enemy is my friend. The average white working class voter sees my enemy's enemy is my friend. These people, they look down at me, and I'm not going to vote for the people who look down on me. And
yeah.
He doesn't look down on me. Right. And that's not reptilian. That's not reptilian.
First off, we can do both. We should be able to do both. Yeah. The illegal immigration has been a problem because, quite frankly, when the economy was booming, even under Republican administrations, nobody gave a shit because we all wanted people to mow our lawns and shuffle our books at the Amazon warehouse and pick our vegetables. And we Americans didn't feel that was beneath us. We weren't going to do it. So we had cheap labor and we didn't care where it came from. And at some point,
you're singing my song
said,
now,
enough, right? Somebody said, then we said enough. And then we went, I think, and put in some draconian measures. Yeah. Everybody's got to, but we all know towns. I go through West Virginia all the time. We got, you know, kind of a family place out there. You know, we're tied to it in many ways. And I go through, and there's a struggling communities, and a lot of it is a complete failure of imagination of policy, coal dried up, and then what are you going to do? And local leadership did nothing. We used to have boom towns, remember, in the old West, people just picked up and left, but you know, that's not the current future. But nothing's been done, and the policies have just been garbage, from all sides, because we'd rather.
It's sell
them crap than real vision of what's really going to help. But the jobs left, all that stuff.
I think it's even more insidious than what you're describing, although I agree with everything you said, because first of all, Republicans and the business community is the big beneficiary and rich people of illegal immigrants. Yeah. I mean, obviously.
Yes. Yes.
And so you wonder, what does the Democratic Party see in it? They see votes and
voters. Yeah.
They see votes. And the truth is that wasn't that long ago. It was very trendy. Michael Moore, you know, he became famous by championing the cause of the white working class. Roger and me, you know, that's how he broke through. So this was very near and dear to the hearts of liberal America at the time. And they've just moved on. They've just moved on. Like, they're like, well, there's no more votes there. So let's see how we can look at the illegal immigrants. And I'm not the slightest bit, I don't have any animosity towards illegal immigrants. I would do it too. And I've hired illegal immigrants and I have friends with illegal immigrants. I know people have gotten married. There's nothing in me even slightly against illegal immigrants, but I just think if I were a white working class guy in a town where that was on its way down and opioids and the factories were closing and I saw the Democratic debates, all this talk about what should we do for illegals when they cross the border? What should we give them this? Should we give them that? I'd be like, what the fuck? Like, what about me? I'm an American. I've been here for generations. You used to care about me.
But that might have been the vote. That might have been a discussion 5 years ago. I mean, I watched these debates. I didn't see that.
in the Democratic primaries, how many want to give medical care to illegal immigrants? How many want to decriminalize illegal immigration? How many? It's all about a total focus, and it's a legit issue. I'm just saying.
It is a legit issue.
But I'm saying.
But you're describing in a white community was what's happening in our black communities, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And they're still absolutely a train wreck.
I'm just saying. And then nobody would call the black community reptilian. Like when black people complain about Harlem turning white. Look, nobody says that's their reptilian brain speaking. Nobody would ever say such a thing.
Your larger point is spot on, which is calling an entire population or segment of America something ridiculous, which is why, again, I'm not a freaking socialist or communist, and I'm not going to authorize concentration camps and whatever QAnon is spouting, because, you know, I believe that climate change is a freaking catastrophe that's coming. And I want to reconsider some, you know, or how we do our foreign policy. And I believe in our allies. And I think we should do better medically. I've lived in Europe. I've seen better models. We can do better. And we've got a pandemic. We haven't even touched that one. It's a complete disaster and 250,000 dead. I am not a socialist. I spent 25 years in uniform. I'm not a fucking communist. I love this country, and I don't think I need to defend it, but that's what's going on. It's like, I'm a socialist commie that wants to put in, you know, totalitarianism. That's bullshit. So on your side, it's the same.
Boris, go ahead.
I hope you don't think I was implying that. No, not you guys.
I was just going to mention that it's funny because now the conversation is framed as a right versus left thing. But even like Bernie Sanders, who I'm not a huge fan of, but I saw an interview with him with Ezra Klein, who is very much for kind of the open borders model.
Yeah.
And he was very clear about the fact that, you know, even historically, if you're a populist leader, especially, it lowers wages when you have people coming in. And like, I think we've talked about it on the podcast before, even how like Cesar Chavez and them used to go around beating up immigrants because they saw it as a threat to the working class wages, not to justify it, but just
you have to have a pipeline. The reason our country has been so successful is because we always have a positive freaking birth rate, and you got to have a pipeline of replacements, and people come in, they take the jobs nobody wants. First generation digs a ditch, picks a cabbage. The kids go to our schools, learn the language, go to high school, and go to the next level. And that allows all of us who've been here a couple generations to keep bumping up. So I get my master's degree. My kid gets a PhD. And keep – that's been our model, and it's been extremely successful. Like I said, I lived in Italy half my life.
Hatem, you understand what he's saying?
Increasing population. It doesn't work.
Hatem, you understand what he's saying?
Russia is plummeting. You know, he's
saying that my kid's going to go to high school.
He's saying you should fucking learn to speak English already.
You know, I think that connects nicely to what you were describing earlier with the rate of, you know, education and the level of intelligence that we need for serving in the military. Does that also maybe reflect the type of immigration pipeline that we need, where right now we should perhaps be prioritizing those immigrants that are going to contribute that have either higher end degrees or are more likely to get those degrees and contribute at that level rather than drive down working class wages?
I don't want an immigrant to come in from Finland who speaks 8 languages to take my freaking job, right? I mean, honestly. So, but what we do need is we've always counted on the first generation to come in and take the hard jobs. And that's what they've been doing. They pick the fruits. They do the road construction. Yeah. They do the stuff that I use Italy as a model because I live there. They're having a huge unemployment problem because they go to these very tough high schools. They take their final exams or universities, and they don't have those jobs. And after all that, they're not going to go freaking put asphalt on the ground. So they still have to bring in some kind of immigrant, and that's the tension, right? Like, immigrants are taking our job. They're taking a job that you are not going to do. There's plenty of unemployment in Florida picking oranges. No one's going to go down and do that shit.
I want to say a couple of things and then ask the final question. Well, that's why I like the Jews, because they don't take your jobs. They just take your land. But that was pretty good. Come on. That was pretty good, Norm.
Good job, world audience.
Hey, I'm half, so I That top screen is 12.5% tried.
The other thing is like the open border, and I said it in the podcast before, I changed, you know, dramatically my views in that. I was for it before I got in, and once I got in, I'm against it now because I don't want more people to come in.
Better.
Shut the door behind you.
So my last two questions to you, Mike, before we end. One, do you think immigrants should serve in the army right away? Do you think they will fight as hard as, because I think they will take it as a job, not as a officer. I don't know. That's a question for you. And the second thing, does the army really mostly support Trump, like he says?
All right. The second one is tough. I'm going to go on the second one that the Military Times recently did a poll. They're pretty well divided. The military represents American fabric, and you can break it down by age, sex, background, education, and find very similar trends. The first one is near and dear to me because, like I said, I was born overseas, learned English as a second language. Came to the States and did, you know, my brother, I did 25 years in the Army. My brother's a Navy captain. My third brother is an Army major. My fourth brother's a Purple Heart Marine with two tours in Fallujah. So immigrants get the job done. Our Army was founded by immigrants. If it wasn't for Baron von Steuben advising Washington, General Lafayette, we would not have an Army today. A hero of 9/11, Rick Rescorla, who was with Hal Moore, in the Yadrang Valley in Vietnam and then got all the people out of the tower on 9/11 and died, was an immigrant. So I've had immigrants. I had Iraqi soldiers or Iraqi Americans that had been interpreters in Iraq join the U.S. Army after getting there and were with me in Afghanistan. And so they were Iraqi American immigrants fighting with me in Afghanistan. Yeah. So I've had everybody from South America to Nigeria in my ranks. They are dedicated Americans, do not see it as a job. They see it as their way, their path to full acceptance. They're the most American of Americans because they want it.
Now, I'll probably caveat, more patriotic I, than a lot of Americans.
I 100% agree with you, and I'm glad you
I'll
said
caveat
that.
that we've learned recently with China,
yeah,
that sometimes you've got to make sure you've got your intel stuff straight, your counter intel, and you got to be careful. But
we just had that cop in New York.
Yeah, that was in the reserves and had a clearance. Was,
you know, I'm really happy you said that because I agree 100%. I always said that, you know, our war against terrorism would not be successful if we didn't have a lot of Muslim and Arab allies and
absolutely
intelligent and all that.
Absolutely.
So yeah, 100%. And you know, well, I want to thank you so much for your service and for being here and for clear things. And what we learned today: Army is good, Jews are bad.
Come on.
I have to say, but Norm, I have one more joke. Can I tell you? Because nobody ever laughed at it. But you know, whenever you say, like, you know, like people have purple hearts and stuff like that, medals and stuff, I always say, like, I have a lot of friends in the Iraqi army, but they only got like participation medals, and nobody laughed at that, and I think it's hilarious. So, Mike, well, thank you so much.
Very more confident. You can't sell a joke where saying, well, nobody thinks this is funny.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it's funny, and that's my trick that I say nobody thinks.
Well,
it's funny.
Well, I always want to shout out the 9th Iraqi Division. I advised them in 06, and the guy that I was with, my partner, the colonel, and is a general now, and he led the ground assault against ISIS with the Iraqi 9th Division, General Qasem. So these are phenomenal people, and their countries and is you know, Iraq's in a difficult place right now. And it's still really important for us to help them and continue to have that as part of our national foreign policy.
Hey, Mike, I have a question for you before we go.
Yeah,
and you don't have to answer it. I don't know if it's a question I shouldn't ask, but I am curious.
You phrase your question like Hatem phrases his jokes.
Yeah.
But I'm actually sincere. How many hours did you spend in your life? Have you spent in your life in actual, where you felt you could die at any minute, like actually threatened, you know, in the heat of battle, whatever it is, like just in that kind of fear? How much time have you spent like that?
Great question. I don't know. It goes back to the premise of my perfect war movie. It's 12 hours long with 30 seconds of absolute sheer terror. That's probably the ratio of my 25 years in uniform.
But it's hours, like, minutes?
It's probably hours.
Hours.
It's hours.
So that's
hours. I don't think it's days. It could be close, but
That's got to take a toll on you. That's got to take a huge toll.
It does, physically and morally and spiritually. But again, being aware of it, processing through it. There are some support tools that are available, and taking them as a growth experience rather than an injury.
I mean, I'm not saying this is quite the same thing, but I'm married.
I'm on my second combat tour.
So, Mike, thank you so much. You're great. What's next for you now?
That's how you tell a joke, Hatem.
Yeah.
Whatever.
You know, I don't know. I love doing this. I don't think I can get a paycheck doing this. I'd love to do more of it. I've been trying to write. I mean, I got my job on the side. I got a day job. It's been good. I'm raising. I have a 4-year-old daughter, and we started late. We adopted, and that's my pride. That's my passion. Is a better America for her. I don't know. I don't know what the next chapter is. There'll be a 2.0 though.
Working in the book, you said. Are you involved in your organizations?
Not yet. Not yet. A lot of op-eds and kind of taking the uniform off allows you to be a lot more expressive.
Yeah.
Can I just say
it's been fun.
Much like our protests, it sounds like war is mostly peaceful.
Hey, Hatem, come on. You're out of time. Okay, I got to go.
Hold on. I want to talk to you. Hold on. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, guys. Well, thank you so much. Mike, it was a pleasure. And thank you for the service. Thank you for being here. And boys, do you have anything to share? Your podcast coming up?
Bushwick Bears on all social media is our podcast. And Mike, thank you for your service.
Mike, you want to, you guys have to follow Mike on Twitter. You want to share your information, Mike?
Yeah, Mike Jason 73. It's been fun.
Thank you so much. Go
ahead. No, no.
No, keep in touch.
No, I didn't. I stepped on. Say it again.
Mike Jason 73.
I felt bad that I didn't say thank you for your service. I'm allergic to.
Oh, it's okay.
I'm allergic to cliches. I know that it's real.
I agree.
Yeah.
Thank you for your support.
And 73 is my favorite number because when we beat the Jews in the war. Mike, thank you. And if you're in New York, you should come and visit us at the Comedy Cellar when it's open very, very soon.
We look forward to it.
All right. Thank you, guys. Noam, hold on.
Allergic to cliches, but the sentiment I agree with is what I'm saying. I just feel like I'm going through the motions. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.